After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Welcome back to The Greenhouse, dear listeners. It's me, Adi, your host, and I'm joined back by our DC correspondent, Josh.
Hello, everyone.
And we're just here to, you know, chop it up about something we've been doing for a very long time now. And I think it's that activity that's worth doing and not worth doing at the same time. And like I said earlier, I wasn't going to get into a breakdown of the 2021 midterms. But I think the discussion just popped up so naturally that I wanted to have you on to kind of just unpack this. I don't have a better word for it. This is
it's the death of democracy as we know it. that's the general takeaway. The Democrats will never win another election again, based on what happened in Virginia. So that's the somber note that we're going to start on.
Right, and this just means, you know, the next election is going to be the most critical election of our lifetimes. They'll fumble the bag one election cycle, and they'll be like, "Don't worry, we'll win this in 2024." Only to fumble it worse in 2024 to be like, guys, 2028's our shot. We need you to double down even harder.
Well, and it's kind of a way to sort of temper expectations, which is fine, right, for like the midterms, right? You know, it's sort of like, oh, well, you know, guys, we're not going to do that great next year. But it's also sort of like recusing themselves of responsibility as well. And frankly, I mean, like the 2021 midterms, if you will. I mean, they're not a proper midterm. It's a complete off-cycle election. There were some decent outcomes as well. I mean, New Jersey, which is sort of lost in all of this, you know, you have the first Democrat reelected there, and I mean, can't remember the exact period, but forever, but for however long, and he wins by a very similar margin to what Youngkin won in Virginia. But we are choosing to focus on this loss, and it's really bizarre because, I mean, you kind of often hear how Democrats play on the defensive when it comes to the media and the media narrative, right?
Right.
You know, it's like the Republicans generally define the cycle. They're defining what's being argued about. And we kind of see that a little bit with with just the issues at hand in the cycle, right? Critical race theory and it kind of being blown out of proportion by them, and Democrats kind of playing a very coy defensive game with it. That really wasn't effective in any way. And it kind of, I think, sort of extended that, the reach of that topic just being kind of like, well, we don't want like parents involved with the classroom, which, you know, maybe that's true, but you don't need to like say that out loud when these parents are the ones that are going to be voting for you, not, you know, their kids. I guess they might vote for you in a few years, but you know, that's not gonna be for a while, but it's sort of weird where, like, you know, I was saying where they're more defensive, but even with this midterm results, they're choosing to focus more on the Virginia loss than the New Jersey victory, or even like not even really embracing sort of like an even ground, right? Where it's like, well, you know, it's a mixed outcome, right? And there's other down ballot races that had other results too that were disfavorable or favorable to the party, but it's really just this focus on like, oh, well, you know, we need a correct course because we lost here.
It begs the question, like, why is Virginia the kind of focus in this sense, right? Because it's not a safe state for either party. You know what I mean? It leans Democratic, but not really.
What I think that maybe that's sort of the thing. We tend to focus on these states that are treated as battlegrounds for the purpose of the presidential election and are like kind of swing states more generally, even in the midterms, because like there's sort of a kind of misinformed thing that, like, you know, so goes Virginia in this case, so goes the nation. And we just kind of apply this to all the swing states, and they're not a block, right? And they're not, like, obviously, you know, winning Virginia in a presidential election is good. And I mean, winning it in general is good. But like, again, it's like, it's not like such a commanding loss that they should necessarily be taking away that the party needs to completely restructure the way it's working, right? And I think we, right. I mean, And to some extent, we, you know, I wonder, I still haven't totally processed the response of passing the infrastructure, but the bipartisan infrastructure bill immediately, more or less immediately after the results came in. It's sort of this midnight thing. And like, I don't know, is it that like, well, now we're going to actually create the impression that we're doing things? Is this sort of like the signal that, and frankly, I don't know how powerful a signal it is that we're killing the reconciliation bill because we were using this as sort of leverage to try to get Joe Manchin to play ball. I don't necessarily know how effective that strategy was in the first place either, to be honest. And to be fair, I think that that take is something that like is frankly like not to necessarily describe ourselves as like this ivory tower sense, but it's something that like only like deeply entrenched leftist politicos are really thinking about.
The wonks.
Yeah, you're like, you know, the average person's not thinking like, oh, you know, they just crushed half their agenda. Like, no one is thinking that.
And I'm almost wondering too, like, does the focus on Virginia have anything to do with the recent obsession in the Democratic strategy on suburbs and suburban voters? Like, the only, you know, stereotype I have of Virginia is that it is the strip mall of America. That's the only real thing I have going for it, right? And of the different culture war issues that made it in the governor's race, the only really loudly speaking people you'd see about it are those suburban types. And for the race to come on such thin margins like that, and with declining voter turnout, my immediate suspicion without doing any research is that it's suburban people who participate in elections more often than not. And since these are the bases that are getting hyped up on either end.
Well, and it's the most fickle base too, right?
Right, right.
It's the base that's willing to vote against Trump because he was kind of mean and they just didn't really like that, but is willing to vote for someone who largely carries the same brand of politics, just is a little bit more, you know, pleasant on the eyes, pleasant on the ears. And then that's like good enough. And I think it's a bizarre fixation on like this demographic where like, I'm not going to say that like suburban voters aren't like important for elections. Like obviously they are. And I mean, I fully understand why either party would want to have that in their base. The problem is that I think particularly the Democrats fail to kind of acknowledge the lack of commitment that those voters really have for either brand. Yes, there were trends that they were going more of their way. But it's sort of the trouble with studying elections in general is you're ultimately studying one-off events, mm-hmm. right? The 2020 election, the 2021 election, whatever election only happened once.
Mm-hmm.
Though, you know, depending on who you listen to, maybe that's not, maybe it never happened at all. And we're all just living in a government coup by the deep state. But, you know, these are one-off events and people always try to like sort of unravel every root cause of any given outcome. Right. And it's like, well, you know, maybe there's all of these likely play some role, but they aren't not necessarily guaranteed to push things in the same direction next time, right? You know, I think the pandemic surely hurt Trump in 2020. Now it might hurt Democrats more as people are sort of the political will to sort of fight back against the pandemic, the willingness to participate in, you know, wearing masks, getting vaccinated is starting to wear off. And I think even among the people who have already been doing these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's probably the sense that they're feeling some level of futility with their efforts, especially when, you know, you have people, you know, wearing, you know, fake Stars of David and like claiming that, you know, vaccinations are the equivalent of the Holocaust. And I think that that's going to start having a fatiguing effect on Democrats who are trying to maintain some sort of government control over these things, whether or not they be mask mandates or other things like that.
Right, right. And it's begging the question almost like there was definitely more of a visible presence of people who you could say were like visible supporters of Biden and his agenda,
mm-hmm.
but as less and less seems to actually have gotten done, like, who still, you know, is willing to bat for him? Who's here saying, trust me, Biden has made it work for me?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's always sort of the tricks of politics in general. Yeah. And in democracy as a whole, slow moving. Regardless of, you know, the institutional features that we have that make it even worse, as far as expediency is concerned. But you're right. Like, I mean, like, who can really claim, like, I think the only people who really can be like enthusiastic are like just people who, I guess, for whatever reason, like, identify with the president or identify with the party, but they don't necessarily, they're not that invested in the outcomes. Right. Like, I mean, I see a lot of academics who are like, oh, you know, like they talk about the outcomes, like, oh, why these things are important. But like, these outcomes don't affect them in any tangible way. They don't really affect a lot of people in a tangible way. And it's sort of hard to conceptualize that. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that's in the reconciliation bill and some of the stuff that's in the bipartisan bill, they have things that I think are a little bit more universally useful. I mean, obviously, if you mean test that away, then you lose a bit, but you have these things that are easier to point to, right? Where you're like, this, we gave you this, you should vote for us. And we're not really, I mean, 2021 shows that we're not really campaigning on what we're doing for you. And even like the Virginia state legislature, from what I understand, had done a number of good things, but they weren't really like talking about that when they were trying to go out to voters. They were doing, you know, at least as far as like the campaign advertisements. I mean, I think I shared with you that flyer where they're like, what basically looks like an RNC flyer connecting Youngkin with Trump, except it's paid for by the Democratic Party of Virginia. It's like, well, great way to like put out like free advertisements for your opponent. Like, the number of people who are dissuaded by this, were already going to vote against him.
No, it was more like Youngkin supports Trump's agenda. It's like, you know how much of like a green flag that can be for someone?
Exactly.
As opposed to a red flag. Like, if you just say outright, no satire, no statement to, you know, make you question it. It was just stated as a plain fact. Like, it's implied the person reading it was going to be offended.
Well, and I mean, and that always has like the tricky thing of defining what was or is Trump's agenda, period, that I think is never, right. It's always been this sort of squishy thing. I think, you know, just there's some obvious things like the wall and I guess jobs, but that's kind of like vague, and everyone, like, whose agenda is against jobs, right? Like, no one's going to run and like, I want to like reduce jobs in this country. It's never going to happen.
Yeah, I know we said we weren't going to do it in like an election breakdown, but now it's actually like begging the question, like, what is the agenda anymore? What, like, you're right, Trump doesn't really have an agenda. It's like Biden's agenda. I mean, there wasn't exactly much there either. It was something for the pandemic, something about the economy.
Well, I think the thing is he falls into the same trap as a lot of other, like, I mean, probably the closest allegory I can think of in more recent memories, like sort of like an allegory, where it's just like boring policy specifics that, like, and not to like demean some of these policies in any way. Like, I mean, obviously, like, I mean, I think, you know, if we actually get these passed, you know, like paid sick leave, paid family leave, all these things are very good. But like, he didn't like campaign on these per se, or at least it wasn't like a focal point. Yes, I'm sure someone could point out, like, oh, it's on his website under, you know, like, page 100.
It wasn't, like, campaigning for Medicare for All, where it's like, okay, you exactly. know what there he's
wasn't,
trying to push.
There wasn't some, like, quick, snappy thing to say, like, this is what I'm running on. It's just, I'm kind of running on, like, vague things that'll improve your life. In some way, hopefully. Really, it was more so running against, like, I'm not Trump. And yeah. I'm actually going to, like, treat the pandemic like it's serious. And I mean, I think what the main takeaway from 21, right, is that, like, I think his, you know, we had the Virginia race was kind of, they try to make it against Trump. It's like, well, except he's not on the ballot and he's not in office anymore either. So you really can't punish him per se. in the same meaningful way. And it's like, you know, like, would he have been upset if Youngkin lost? I mean, he probably would have just like laughed at him, called him a loser, and pretend he never endorsed him.
Right.
Like, it's not a real loss for him one way or the other. But I think that that's kind of the large takeaway that I think is that it's just this focus on someone who's no longer in power, and that's going to just, like, we need to find better strategies to entice voters.
Right, right. I mean, I think that's a very fair breakdown of what happened in 2021. And I think it paints, you know, what we were actually trying to get to today, which is the media and how it interacts with the Democratic Party and its extended networks of patronage. And it's particularly, I guess, I don't know how to put this other than like it's invisible, because through my life, my short lifetime, like, this has been the reality of every president and possibly every other political figure, right? We had Bush, Obama, Trump, and now Biden. And it's still the same degree of the media's proliferation and dominance in the sphere. But I think some of those relationships have changed. But that intense and incestuous, I don't have a better word for it, that incestuous relationship between the Democratic Party and its mainstream media arms, not to bring in, you know, Trumplingo into this, but very, very telling how he pointed to mainstream media. And it's like, you can't exactly say he's wrong there. You can't.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been that conspiracy, right, that the mainstream media is kind of out to get Republicans. And I don't, like, wholly buy it, but you do see, like, I mean, at the same time, when you see reporters and other talking heads in these networks where it's like, yeah, this guy worked for the DNC on Democratic campaigns for however many long, and you see Republicans in there too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... But the thing is, like, those Republicans, they're not the modern brand anymore, right? Because it's like, mm-hmm. oh, this is like some ex-Bush guy. And now that's seen as like a rhino, right? Or like a rhino at best, or a liberal at worst by these people. So it's just, it's mm-hmm. kind of this weird thing. And it's that it's sort of been this, it's sort of like this breeding ground of like just kind of the politicians who have just been thrown to the wayside, or like other you know, party figureheads that have just been thrown to the wayside. Cuomo. Like, yeah, Chris Cuomo. I mean, even like, I mean, on the Republican side, I mean, Chris Christie, right? I mean, I think I actually saw something funny for him the other day where it was like, how did I can't remember if it was like a title for a memoir or something, but it was like how I went from a Trump critic to a, or a Trump supporter to a Trump critic. It's like, well, you were fired. That was really, that's the journey, right? You were fired.
Yeah, you were critic. Like, you made a big deal out of being like a how dare you sir Republican to like begging for a cabinet gig,
and then you got dropped for
2 days, and then like,
yeah. So it's, but it's like, yeah, you get, and it's kind of funny too, because it's like we rely, the media seems to rely at least for their political coverage on these X figures. And it's sort of weird where they sort of dictate the narrative of like how to win campaigns and stuff like that, when it's like, well, you guys have lost, right? I mean, like Chris Carville, like we take him out of his crypt every
Chris James, I forget what his name is.
Yeah, but it was like, you know, I was like the main one that was like, you know, like James Carville, like who like won with Clinton, but right. It's like he lost with Kerry. He lost with, I had to look this up, in 2020 he actually worked with Mike Bennett.
I do remember this. Yes, I do remember I was like, this.
But you know, it's like this is someone who we still treat as like, this is someone who knows how everything works. This is someone who knows how to win. Even though he's lost 1,000 times too. Doesn't matter.
That, and like, we have this like mystification over how political campaigns work.
Yeah.
And they're kind of, they are effectively a free for all space. Like you can fill it up with people who you think are respectable professionals, but everyone's kind of an independent contractor in a business whose product is the candidate. That's kind of how campaigns operate. And, you know, what's particularly insidious about Carville and his ilk in, you know, campaigning is they'll tout their election successes as expertise on prescriptions for actions or policy, rather than, you know, hey, you got to get this many people engaged. This is how you engage media markets. The actual, like, meat and potatoes of campaigning, they will never seem to pontificate on at all. They are brought on to, like, say, actually, this is never going to let you win.
Yeah, and it's weird because, like, they almost focus particularly on, like, messaging and whatnot and, like, the political brand of these figures, and that's sort of what determines what works. Kind of ignorant of the fact that, like, it's sort of, like, that brand really only matters in that particular moment, right? Like, you know, like, Clinton is a successful candidate in 92 because he speaks to that moment. And, I mean, there's also some other issues with that election, too. But largely, that is why he is a successful candidate there. Whereas, would he be a successful candidate in, like, you know, you keep all of the, you know, control for everything? Would he be a successful candidate in 2020? Probably not. But, you know, it's sort of that. But yeah, you're right. You know, there's that meat and potato stuff that, like, they probably know better than most people, right? But that's not the stuff that, like, you know, they don't analyze, like, well, you know, like, so-and-so's ground game really sucked or anything like that. Like, anything from, like, a technical perspective that campaigns do falter on in some cases.
That never gets brought up. Like, post-2016, no mainstream, I mean, no outlet, CNN and MSNBC are who I'm pointing at here, but no outlet pointed to the fact that, like, oh, yeah, Clinton 2016's campaign ground game in the Midwest was shot. There was no one.
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of, like, you know, and maybe it wasn't on them. It was more so just, like, on, like, Twitter takes and stuff like that, where it was like, well, you know, like, she should have visited Michigan instead of Texas or whatever, and things like that. But you're right, you know, it's like there's more than just, like, the actual candidate visits. There's right. like that ground game stuff, but, like, and you're right. I think that, like, those particular outlets weren't focused on that. It's just sort of on, like, this deep peril of, like, oh my God, you have this, you know, like, how could Trump have won? Like, this is impossible. Clearly,
it had to be the Russians. It had to be the goddamn Russians.
Well, it's the Russians, or, like, I mean, I think before, like, we realized the full extent, like, of the popular vote, like, when it just seemed like, yeah, he won. There was kind of like, I guess this country is, like, irredeemable and racist, which, you know, I guess jury's still out. But
it's like 2016 is when you can make that declaration, not at any other point in the nation's history.
Right. Yeah. Like, well, and that's just kind of like an ongoing trope with the media, and particularly, I think, you know, like, kind of how the, you know, sort of partisan partnership goes, right? That, you know, only like, the only occasionally will we, like, hit a point where it's like, oh wow, you know, like, this is, like, new racial tensions or things like that, not things that have been in the back burner forever, or have been, like, ongoing. Like, this is maybe something, you know, like, a slightly different discussion branching off, but I know I've seen, you know, there's certain things that, like, the media will, I mean, the media criticizes figures in both parties a lot for different things, but it's interesting that you don't usually see Democrats criticized for, like, doing things that Republicans do and get criticized for, you know, like immigration, like a lot of the stuff that they do at the state level, where in some cases, like, there are blue states that still have the same troubles that we always blame Republicans for. It's like, well, clearly, you know, you're in control, you're choosing not to do this, or you're actively hurting it in some way. So, like, you know, I mean, like, there's certain things that, like, it's, we don't, or the media, rather, like, doesn't, like, categorize the blame for these decisions, and it's always kind of, it does sort of lead to that you know, that in sort of invisible partnership that you were talking about, right? It's not just what's covered, but what isn't covered.
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe I have to apply the mindset I was doing on the Piss series and bring me into this part four, which is, because I know in part two we were talking about the establishment and the culture war, but yeah. I think, and that may be, the, you know, talking about the establishment, that's the structure of the Democratic Party as an institution. We've already covered that. But I think we should, you know, maybe point to the media itself, because it at least touts itself as a separate entity, even if they seem intertwined. And its job is to basically transmit and sell information. That's mm-hmm. broadly what it does. But, you know, what it seems to do, at least in my simple, like, socialist analysis, is like, well, it's to sell any information counter to the actual material conditions people are seeing in front of them, or any narrative that, you know, will point to the fact or that will point away from the fact that power is, you know, consolidated by America's wealthy, and we have a system designed to keep it that way. And, you know, trying to make it a little more equal in any sense, you know, that's dangerous. Anything that points away from that, go for it.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because it's like, you know, I think to some extent, you know, like major candidates like Bernie Sanders and sort of like we've kind of seen with like the emergence of like the Squad and whatnot is they can't totally avoid these discussions anymore. Mm-hmm. But they sort of embrace it as this way of like just like, oh, you know, like, you know, old Uncle Bernie, crazy little idealist, you know, just, you know, like keep on dreaming. But like, know that this is like impossible. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like it's this weird as like dichotomy that like has sort of emerged where it's, you know, we have to acknowledge these things. We have to acknowledge that, like, you know, the material conditions are not as rife as we would like, as you know, we try to portray, right? That, you know, there is like an increasing class divide, but we also don't really present the remedies for them, at least not on a lot of these media things. And to some extent, I think, you know, the 24-hour cycle on like these major news networks, I think is sort of harmful to that, because I think it's less journalism and more just talking heads pontificating about things one way or the other, bringing on people to debate on the given issues. And I think, you know, it's like you have, for as much discourse as you have on any given news item of the day, it doesn't feel like much knowledge is being produced or transmitted, despite the fact that you have, you know, 20-some people talking about it.
And that's what gets tricky, because, you know, people, I don't think people naively assume that you go to the news to find out what's going on, but like a lot less of it, whether it's cable news or whether it's like old style journalism, like newspapers and stuff, it's less reporting and straight to the editorials, straight to the columns, straight to the debate. And I wanted to maybe talk to someone who maybe is apolitical, like, what do they think of this? But it just kind of creates this assumption. It's like you have to be part of, you know, an ivory tower type class to understand what's going on here. Or, you know, you have to come in with a particular take off the bat. And that's where you have people, I guess, adopting an ideology off the bat. But all that aside, you know, it creates this impression that there's basic information out there and the people doing it are professionals, but it kind of immediately obfuscates the purpose of getting that information out there. You know what I mean? Where it's like, hey, like in straight political reporting, let's say that, like, hey, there's a bill and it's being contested right now. Here's who's on this side. Here's who's on this side. And it goes straight into, I mean, I'm trying to think, like, who do we pick on in a specific, you know, example? Let's see. Let's go straight to CNN for mine, where, like, they'll go to that fucking round panel they do. And they have Van Jones and some just despicable like hedge fund guy on the other side.
I know they fired Rick Santorum, but let's pretend he's
still let's say he's still there. Again, why would you have Rick Santorum there? Like, what is he saying there that like is giving you insight?
Well, it's kind of, I mean, this is maybe an aside, but isn't it kind of bizarre that you have like that it's like a celebrated choice when they fire Rick Santorum, but it's like you had employed him for like 4+ years.
That's what I'm saying. Like, why?
Nothing's new here. It's the same guy.
Like, I'm almost wondering, like, because it's not exactly like this is, I get the idea of like, well, if you hired a bunch of professors who were experts in their field, let's say, and they had discussions about the news, it would be boring. Okay. What is Rick Santorum bringing that's particularly interesting either? It's not even interesting. He's just saying things that are inflammatory.
It's the same thing. Like, there's just this idea you need to have your token, you know, maybe this adjective's unnecessary, but you have to have your token wacko conservative, right? You have him on, you know, CNN. You had, you know, Meghan McCain on The View. You know, every station has to have its, like, I guess ABC has, like, Chris Christie. I have plenty of issues with him, but he's a little bit more even-keeled. You have to have that token figure to like represent the other side.
You need the rogues gallery delivering the news. And it's like, what about that? I guess I should have done a little more research. Like, what led to that model in the newsroom?
That's a good question.
Like, because, you know, you can definitely like with reasonable suspicion say, well, of course it's more entertaining. It gets more views, makes more money probably. But what brought it across?
I kind of wonder if, like, is that really the only utility that it has is just entertainment? Is there any, like, informational utility that you have of having the rogues gallery there? Because it makes, like...
They're well-educated rogues. That's the other thing. They are part of...
That's true, yeah. They're well-educated in whatever they're, you know, talking about, right? I mean, you have them of their various schools of political thought, and they're very, you know, well attuned with that side's argument. But it's just like, if you're just looking for information, and like, I guess I can't think of anything where like I've kind of like gone into one of these, I haven't literally gone into any of these newsrooms, but like going to sit down on the TV, to watch the TV and listening to these newsrooms, I've never gone in on one where like I didn't really know kind of what to expect. I didn't know what they were talking about. Like, I kind of always did know, but I wonder if I didn't have that baseline knowledge, what would I get out of this? Would I come out of that with like, I understand what's going on, or would I just be confused?
I went in confused. Like, I mean, me as like a... I think, you know, coming off of where I was, where it's like, I'm just this kid concerned about the environment and I'm learning about politics for the first time. And you see like these debate programs, you hear the one guy who seems to be on your side for whatever reason. And you just, that's why they're called talking points, because they're a comfortable place from which you can, you know, exposit. And you learn to pair it. I don't know how else to say it other than, you know, like when you engage in that kind of political media, whether it's cable news, whether it's old school press like newspapers and magazines, even podcasts, if I'm being perfectly honest. I mean, how many insufferable liberals do you know who like quote Pod Save America?
Well, I was gonna say that like kind of like one of the things that we'll probably talk about this later, but like one of the ways that we're seeing like media evolve is sort of it's kind of become like just some idiots of a podcast putting out their views. I'm like, I know it's a little meta, but you know, it's like it does seem like, you know, kind of like we are approaching the sort of media model where like it kind of originates from, you know, that, you know, the round table of lunatics, that, you know, it's sort of evolved from there, where except now it's just like it's the one guy from that round table is just, it's just his voice and like some yes man. And it's like it's this weird thing, right, where it's like this is how we are increasingly, I think, consuming information, is like through these weird podcast shows, which are entirely kind of exposed to like self-selection bias, because you kind of have to know what you're looking for in order to like find them. I guess occasionally maybe Spotify will drop you an ad, but that's probably only for like Pod Save America and a few other big ones.
Well, yeah, because now what we got to this way very roundabout, but I think what you're pointing at, and I wish we could do a little more like analysis of how this works, but what it's broadly created is that we are in the takes economy. We are in,
yes.
The news is no longer something to like tell you what's going on. It's just something for you to react to.
Yeah, it's something for you to take a side on, increasingly.
Pretty much. It's like, this is what happens. Are you a based nationalist Kekistani? Yeah,
someone was killed. What was his color? How do you feel about that? And like, that's kind of like, it's like, you know, we have like in one of those flow charts, basically, right? To like determine, yeah. You know, you can backwards infer like, okay, this person is conservative,
yes,
or liberal or whatever.
If, yeah.
Based, yeah. Like,
it's like a choose your own adventure for opinions. Like, I don't
exactly. Know. Yeah. Like, this person's dead. Was he killed? Yes. Was it by a cop? Yes or no? What was his color? And, you know, we could kind of just backwards induct from there.
But that's the thing, is like, even as more facts emerge, people just double down on the side they already came
out. It doesn't
on.
Matter.
I mean, it's like with the whole thing with the Kyle Rittenhouse thing that's getting me right now is like, everyone is talking about like, you know, how frustrating it is. And it's like, I get it. This is very bad what's going on here. But it's like, how else did you think the Thin Blue Line crowd was going to act? How else do you think they were going to defend their boy? Like, come on. Like,
and it's kind of wild too, where it's like, I feel like this is a moment that like, is just, people are just coping with it. Like 100% with satire, right? Like, everyone's like putting memes of, you know, Rittenhouse's, you know, over dramatic tears court. The senile old judge who clearly made his decision about this case, you know, last year, probably before it even happened. He knew how he would run this, but it's just like, everything is just like, people are just like completely coping with it with satire, or, you know, on the right, they're just, you know, what a poor kid, you know, he deserves better.
And like, I know we mentioned the society of spectacle, or like politics of spectacle, in the past, but that's kind of what that relationship between the media, the Democratic Party, and by token, the Republican Party, although I think like the exact narratives might be different in either case, this kind of media industrial complex exists to puff up and maintain the spectacle.
Yes.
To what end, aside from obscuring facts of like, you know, this is who holds power in society, I'm not sure what else.
Yeah, one, I think increasingly, like, the spectacle, we kind of, you know, goes back a little bit to what I was talking about, where, like, you know, with Bernie Sanders and other more popular, populist leftist policy proposals and other things like that, and kind of the acknowledgement of this gap, there's been, like, this sort of perceived need from the media, well, we need to represent something more than just the mainstream orthodoxies of both parties.
Mm-hmm.
So we bring in, you know, other, you know, I hesitate to say more liberal Democrats, because the ones I want to talk about, I think, are problematic. But we had to bring in some of them, and we were going to bring in, you know, some other, you know, just people who, you know, might, let's say, dance around fascism on the Republican side. We need to prop them up as well, and kind of just display the spectrum of views, kind of ignorant of what that really does, other than just like, they might try to kill each other live on air. They'll pop a rating.
Right. And like, when you ask them why they do it, they'll say, it's like, well, because we're non-biased. We believe everyone should come. It's like, as if you can like revel in that virtue of having brought everyone to the table. Like, it's like, it matters to me, well, as a fucking viewer. Like,
and it's become increasingly difficult, just I think with politics in general, as like, I think a lot of issues have just become increasingly personal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, you know, it's, you know, oh, we have to represent, you know, both sides of a view. It's like, well, like, when both sides are of a view are whether or not, you know, certain people should even be classified as, like, human beings, basically.
Mm-hmm.
do we really have a right to represent, or do we, is it really ethical for us to present both sides of that argument?
And that's, I might even derail things here a little bit, but it's like, that's kind of where like the fundamental nature of American electoral politics like needs to be called into question, because it happens in the context of these very bourgeois understandings of behavior and of debate and enlightened discussion and things like that. And it's like, there's no enlightened discussion you can have with someone who wants to flip the table over.
Yeah.
There's no enlightened discussion you can have with, I'll just say, if someone's a flat out racist, like, what are you going to talk about meaningfully? I'm not saying you have to fight the person, but just like, why are we having a discussion? Unless it's to appease, like, you know, the person who doesn't want us to break out into a fight.
Right. And I think some people might say that there's still common ground you can have with those people. But I think that sort of still raises questions of like, and I think, you know, you increasingly see it with sort of the discussions more broadly about like bipartisanship, right? Which is increasingly feels, you know, even within those more mainstream orthodoxies, it feels very unattainable in a lot of ways, where it's like, okay, well, like, you know, and always, like, it's always the media narrative that, like, when Democrats are elected, they need to do some things that Republicans want, but, like, very rarely the other way around. You know, when Trump's elected, he doesn't need to, like, do anything that Democrats want. It's his agenda. He won. But, like, Biden, it's like, oh, now it's time to extend the olive branch. But it's like, well, what do you, like, when you're, like, let's take like some of these like bills, right? Like, okay, like we want to like just improve infrastructure in this country. Okay, that's what the Democrats want to do. What do the Republicans want to do? Not that. Which, you know what I mean? So like, what's the olive branch you can even extend there, right? Like, I guess, you know, we just won't do it at all, because, you know, Marco Rubio, and he's considered a more moderate Republican, he said that, like, you know, $1 more in government spending is just, you know, unforgivable socialism. So there's not really like, well, you get this and I get this. There's nothing to really branch that.
There isn't. And that's where there's this view of history that Matt Crispin talked about on his Inebriated Past series. And I think he's gotten this from other authors. So I'm paraphrasing a lot of work here. And I, you know, after this episode, I'm going to shut up about politics and do more reading. But the overall like version of this take is that the Constitution was not designed with ideologically coherent parties in mind.
No.
And it kind of falls apart with the creation of those. And when you have what we had at the start of the founding of the country, which are regional interests that create the party dynamics at first, then compromises emerge because there's no ideological coherence.
Yeah.
And then by the time the parties do reach, I mean, again, you could still argue to the degree of which they're coherent, I would still say that being an American liberal versus being an American conservative are two different ideologies.
Yeah.
You just hit a point where it's like, if you don't want to fucking like work with people, you can throw the gears up, because it doesn't change anything for people who benefit in the status quo.
Well, and I think, I mean, honestly, increasingly, like, not to be completely condescending, but of conservatives, but like, what is their agenda even these days? You know, it's like, if you don't have a clear, I mean, I guess like the main thing is like closed borders or whatever, but it's like, we don't have open borders. We're not like, we're still pretty tough on immigration. We're just less like, you know, in your face about it. We're not like parading the kids in cages. We're just, you know, turning off the lights and please don't look.
Yeah, pretty much not much has changed from Trump's policy on immigration.
Yeah.
And but that was the only thing you could say they had a policy on was immigration.
Yeah. And I think that was like the only thing that was like really clear, right? Cause I mean, like, I guess, you know, I mean, I was like, I guess Trump always said, you know, infrastructure week would happen, but like his party was always pretty open about like, yeah, like this is the one bridge we won't like cross with you. This is the final straw. We'll do anything else, but ethnic cleansing, we're down. Infrastructure, hell no. Get out.
But then it also begs the question, like, for modern American liberals, like, what is there other than, you know, vaguely posturing amongst your most socially liberal bases to, like, the Schoolhouse Rock vision of America, of it being, like, this, you know, constitutional democracy engineered by geniuses, where it's a melting pot, and even though, you know, we did a few bad things, we don't do them anymore. We have capitalism, but we make sure it's fair. Like that kind of like fifth grade civics view of America.
I mean, the thing is that fifth grade civics view allows you to do a lot of really small things and pretend that they're big.
Right.
And that's because I've always like heard this from like former staffers where they'll like talk about how like, because they're usually more gung-ho, they're younger, they're, you know, obviously politically invested, they want to like work in Congress, not as a member, but, you know, as someone who's, you know, the member's servant, basically. And they'll talk about how, like, you're like, oh, we can do this and this. And then, like, the member, like, well, we have to, like, run on other things in the future. So it's like, you know, like, yeah, we could pass healthcare, but, like, we really need to, like, have some issue to run on next election. So let's pass this other thing and call it good.
Which is exactly how it metabolizes. Like,
yeah.
Because you can't get too conspiratorial, even though I'd like to be, of like, so what really is going on behind the halls? Like, what do these people do all day aside from fundraising and stomping their feet, making sure nothing happens?
I mean, it's like bills still get passed, right? And they're not all just renaming post offices, as, you know, much as we might joke about that. And it's just, I think it's just that, like, the game increasingly just feels so rigged against people that, like, it just seems like we need, and I mean, we do need, like, huge structural changes, and, like, we're just putting out a lot of bandages. And, I mean, some of these things are just kind of maintaining some status quo program that exists but has, like, a sunset clause that needs, you know, to be voted on every 3 or 4 years. Like, it's the boring stuff, but, like,
right,
you know, you won't ever credit anyone for keeping it around, but, like, the minute it's gone, people will start, you know, asking questions.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess that's the other relationship between Democrats and the media is just, hey, we need this to look like something. Can y'all make it look like something?
Except it's like they don't do a particularly good job of maintaining that relationship most of the time, do they?
Which, I mean, it begs the question, like, who is the target audience? Aside from, like, you know, the suburban voter who they want to target. Like, when, who's the senator from New York? Schumer. When Schumer was saying that thing about, for every one working class voter we'll lose, we'll pick up two in the suburbs. Yeah, is that who he's referring to?
Well, it's kind of weird too, because it's like, I mean, like, what do we think the people in the suburbs are? Like, most, like, I mean, like, they're not, like, yeah, you have, like, more upper class people, but it's like they're still, like, middle working class people for the most part. People in the suburbs usually have to go to the cities to work. They don't work in the suburbs unless they're, you know, running one of the last few mom and pop shops around.
Right. And of them too, like, how many of them, you know, are part of regular voter turnout? Because it's, again, at an all-time low. So it's just, it's like, to me, it's just the cohort that watches cable news that has the biggest say in our electorate at this point. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of like, I guess it makes sense, right? I mean, if you're watching cable news, they're only talking about, they almost exclusively talk about politics, so you're kind of naturally more inclined to be invested in it, right?
Right.
But yeah, and it's weird. And like, I don't know what impact like having some of these like alternative views are, not just like the, you know, liberal conservative, but like, you know, the more liberal and more conservative ones. Cause I was kind of thinking about this where like I guess just to sort of present that, like, you know, both parties have like a broader umbrella than they do, but like I feel like their choices of who do they like decide to prop up. Like I was thinking recently, like with, you know, someone like Tulsi Gabbard.
Right.
Who like we kind of portray like, okay, this is, to put it in the most generous way possible, like an anti-establishment Democrat, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is representing someone who's against that main cut cloth. But the thing is, she has like all of these other views that are problematic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, this is who we choose as like, this represents like, what a Democrat that's not Hillary Clinton looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just, it like has a very bad, like tainting effect of like the whole thing. And like, and I don't know to what extent, like if you're like putting her or like her like conservative equivalent, or I mean, are they really different? you know, if we're doing that, like I don't know to this extent that they're persuasive in any way, right? Like I don't know if like someone sees like her kind of having an anti-vax view. I don't know if that necessarily like would encourage someone who wouldn't already feel that way to feel that way, or if it's like I don't know necessarily how that relationship works. But I think that like, and you're seeing it kind of with that like alternative, more like podcast focused media too, where you're seeing more of these like leftists who are sort of embracing weird conservative things, like a Jimmy Dore, for instance, where they're sort of embracing like these, like, and I think that like, if we're being charitable, I think he's trying to build a coalition, so to speak, but it's a coalition that like is sort of like a pretty bad mix.
Well, what it is, because I don't know if you've seen like God, this discussion has been all over the place, but you know what? It's a dialectical space. Let's just leave it at that.
It's the media. Come on, it's gotta be all over the place.
It's the swamp, folks. It's the swamp. The thing about like Jimmy Dore and this bullshit that they're on, I mean, you have effectively just, because have you seen like this general strike meeting that they're going to be hosting, and they invited Jimmy Dore for it?
I didn't see that they were inviting him. No.
Well, so they invited Jimmy Dore, they invited Breonna Joy Gray, they invited fucking just the most annoying people, you know, on the internet. Because there's just a certain kind of person or a certain view that like someone generating a lot of airtime and a lot of discussion is someone who's prominent in the discourse, in scare quotes.
Yeah.
And you know, like it's like activism by media consumption, like me consuming this podcast, me consuming this show, is doing the activism. And that applies to the cable news viewers too.
Yeah.
MSNBC moms and dads think that like, you know, they are part of the, you know, resistance that's going to bring down Trump, even though all they're doing is just tuning into the TV at night. It's the same thing with these guys, where it's like, as long as I hang around these, you know, quote unquote subversive media figures who are, I'm not even sure what their angle is, other than if I keep this angle up, it'll drive up engagement. But when it comes to, you know, coherence or like an actual action item, there's not much there.
Yeah, because it's like, I mean, anytime like he's like someone like Jimmy Dore, like, I guess I'll just stick with him as the example. Like his idea of activism just generally sort of sucks. Like
it's just like, be nice to Nazis online. That's it. Like, yeah, well, forgetting how shitty that is. What like, the and like fuck I kind of
like
do?
To be fair, I kind of understand. Like I have a relatively negative view of the willfully unvaccinated. Right, people who are perfectly medically capable of getting the vaccine or choosing not to. I don't have the most charitable view of it.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I think when you have more mainstream liberals, like someone like a Claire McCaskill, kind of like, ah, yes, these unvaccinated people are getting fired. Woo! On media, kind of a bad look. Do I personally agree with it? Perhaps, but I'm not going out on cable TV touting right, those views. Right, I'm right. keeping that in the privacy of, well, I guess, this podcast now. But, you know, I mean, like, I don't necessarily, I'm not propping out those views and saying, like, oh, this is, like, a great thing. And it's like,
we all have like, those. That's what we're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, we all have, like, everyone has views of, like, you know, like, I really don't like these particular people. And, like, if they get screwed, good. Like, but you don't talk about those in a more general
well, because setting. It's purely libidinal. It's purely like, yeah. I like the way on Twitter, you see this a lot, like a guy who does X or making fun of a guy to get mad at, or people like will tell stories about that are so oddly specific. You're like, are you talking about men in general? Or are you talking about an ex-boyfriend? Are you talking about women in general? Exactly. Or are you talking about an ex-girlfriend? Stuff like that, where like, you shouldn't be harsh with people because everyone has done that bad behavior. But at the same time, like, it's one of the dumbest things we do.
Yeah, because like I said, I don't have sympathy for people who are like comparing this to the Holocaust. But like, there are people who I understand that there's a little bit more going on, or they are, you know, they're not all horrible people. But like, let's not, when you're someone who has perceived legitimacy saying that they are, you're kind of inherently presenting yourself as an antagonist. And I can understand where like someone like Jimmy Dore or whatever sees that as like you're trying to present an alternative. The problem is like the way he's doing is it's like, oh well, it's I think his idea is that like we sort of, you know, these Nazis agree with us on fiscal issues, let's, you know, pair up even though they think that you're subhuman. And if we're generous, he's just dumb and doesn't realize that that won't work. If we're less charitable, then, like, I don't know what his agenda is exactly, but it's probably not that good in that case. But it's, and it's like, we choose to prop up people like him as sort of like this, like, oh, well, here's, like, you know, this alternative view, which is sort of this weird thing that is, I don't know. I think it creates this sort of circle where, like, I get, like, where some people kind of come from that argue that, I mean, I don't necessarily think of, like, the political spectrum as, like, a circle. Right. As far as, like, you know, like, oh, once you go far enough one way, you eventually go to the other side. But that's kind of, like, what having someone like Jimmy Dore or Tulsi Gabbard in this position sort of suggests, right? Is that you go far enough one way, you're basically going into the other side.
Well, because like what that ilk kind of represents is like you can probably come in very earnestly feeling outraged because there's a lot to be angry about these days. But
yeah,
and you get a guy like Dore who, like, whether it's performative, whether it's genuine, I don't really care. But like taps into that sense of like, hey, it's okay for me to feel strongly about this. And then his prescription is, let's go straight to general strike with people who we have done no, you know, team building with, who are diametrically opposed to us and honestly don't have the same goals as you. Like, just because they agree with you that working conditions suck doesn't necessarily mean that their vision for a society is better than this one, you know?
Well, their vision of working conditions suck mean that you're supposed to get the shitty jobs. Not
right. Right. Like,
you're supposed to get the shitty jobs. Also not taking away my job, because, you know, obviously brown people taking my job is bad, but you know, so it's this weird layered thing where it's like they don't really want this. And it's the same thing where, like, we talked about, like, with Trump's agenda, right, where how, like, kind of squishy and amorphous it is. There are things that, like, oh, I'm going to bring back jobs. It's like, well, what does that mean? Everyone wants to bring back jobs. Everyone wants to have a job. Everyone wants to have a better job or better conditions in said job. But it doesn't all mean the same thing specifically.
Well, and that's 100% it with, like, all these media narratives we get sold, whether it's, you know, this alternative ecosystem of left media, whether it's, you know, every disgusting thing the right produces, or whether it's, you know, the god-awful swamp of cable news. It's a place for you to put your libidinal frustrations.
Yeah.
That's Matt Crisman's idea, not mine. I need to stop quoting him because I need to read. I need to fucking read. I'm tired. But it feels good to get your rage out so you can put, you can, you know, project your emotions onto it. But the actual, you know, action item is either harmful to a class project or is just consume more of the product. Like, yes. I mean, when, remember when Rachel Maddow did that thing about Trump's tax returns and the big joke was that there was nothing to be seen.
Yes.
But it's a 30 minute segment. So each time she's like, I made it through page 1 through 12, come back after the break. Well, there was nothing because it got you to watch the program. That's it.
Yeah, I remember that was a huge deal because I remember like it was trending everywhere. It was big, but like, again, there was nothing of substance from it. But that did remind me, there was another point I was going to raise, like where I don't know if necessarily Rachel Maddow was necessarily had like where she's come down on like this whole like unvaccinated thing. But it's funny that like it's kind of okay to sort of express your grievances with like this group of people like broadly on like media. But I remember when Trump got COVID and she was like, well, it's a little schadenfreude to you know, wish ill of him. It's like, come on
man,
like it's like if you argue like for 4 years we've argued that this guy is like the spawn devil. Of Satan, the devil, whatever uncharitable thing you can say about him, and when you're given the closest thing you could be to like a gift from Providence to deal with this problem, and you're like, oh, I really hope he recovers. What are we here for? What are we doing? Like,
I guess that's the only point that we can come to meaningfully is like, this is a sham. The media circus around politics and both parties is a fucking sham. There's no reason to like, and it sucks because like you want people to stay informed. You want people to, you know, stay abreast of it. But there's no like, say for like a few sources, there's no real journalism for people to like point at or for them to even consume all the information they need. There's no real action item being prescribed by any of it for a political project.
Well, and I think, you know, to some extent, like, you know, we talked a little bit about the alternative media and like, I think there are some good sources, right? Like, I think, you know, there are people who are like more, what I would constitute as like more, at least more generally, at least my brand of a leftist. There are things like that, but the right just kind of does it better. Or at least they have more traction, right? Like everyone, like, know, like if you use, like if you mention like Breitbart, everyone knows what that is.
Mm-hmm.
They might not read it or anything like that. I've never read anything from there, but like I know what it is. You know, they know what these like other sources are, but like no one has like
the New York Post. Everyone has seen it, even though they don't regularly read it. Stuff like that. Yes. Yeah.
But like no one has like for like whatever the like, you know, left wing equivalents are, they don't have the same level of recognition at all.
Like The Intercept, you only see that on Twitter.
Exactly. And even that
Jacobin, really fuck often. Jacobin, but like you know, you only see it on Twitter, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's I mean, it kind of does beg the question though, cuz like what other option do we have other than C-SPAN?
Well, and I mean, doesn't this kind of get back to like the whole like objective journalism where you kind of, because like C-SPAN, I this is probably the closest you get to really like just pure objectivity, right?
It's just a rolling camera. What's
being, it's the camera. I mean, I guess you're getting whatever takes on the floor, right? But it's just like you're just seeing exactly what is transpiring.
right.
And it doesn't draw views, so.
and that's tricky.
And the other thing, too, is, like, I mean, it kind of, though it sort of relates back to what I was talking about with my, like, issues with the roundtables, is, like, is the layman, the not politically initiated, what do they get out of C-SPAN? Unless, like, it is a specific moment where, like, someone like Ted Cruz is trying to like make a particular point and he obviously will be talking to that, but like if you're like watching just the business of the floor, the business of Congress, so there's some people saying yay and nay, like on what is
mm-hmm.
you know HR 522, what does that mean? I don't know, look it up. Where's your you know GovTrack? But you know, it's, so it's like, it's this inherently, it's not that, like, it's literally accessible in the sense that, like, I just hit the remote, put it in C-SPAN, you know, whatever channel that is in my area. But it's not accessible in the sense of, like, what I'm consuming visually and audibly will necessarily make sense to me as, like, any given individual.
Mm-hmm. I think someone was knocking my door. I need to be right back.
All right.
That's the first time in a while I've had to sign for a package. That's...
Oh, that's weird.
I was like, well, no one knocks. What the fuck is going on here?
Sounds like, okay, this episode's definitely going to put your editing skills to the test.
You know what? People should be happy I'm getting episodes back up in the first place. But
fair enough.
I think it's okay to have a messy episode every now and then. I think people should just know, like, the ideas are floating in the ether.
Yeah, fair enough.
So I think, you know, with all of that being said, like, what does this bode for journalism? And I know journalism is one of those fields that, like, suffers from a lot of self-mythologizing. Like, journalists like to see themselves as, like, these investigators of noble character. And, you know, we know that's not necessarily true, especially with everything we've had to say about the media. But, like, it's kind of worrisome because there is a real need to kind of expose what I'm talking about, which is, like, who holds power? How do they use it? In what ways do they obscure it? How is, you know, it used in unjust means? Things like that. And that's where, you know, investigative journalism particularly has that, you know, kind of duty to do that work and also needs to be supported and protected. But What do you do with it? Because you reach a point where, like, Glenn Greenwald starts The Intercept and then 4 years later, they MK Ultra him into being, like, some kind of...
Well, and just, I mean, everything wrong with Glenn Greenwald in general these days.
How did that happen? That's another thing, like, maybe I didn't anticipate to get into this, but it's like, what happened to some of these people? Like,
yeah, well, I was kind of thinking about that too, because I was thinking about him as, like, another example, and I couldn't remember for sure. I was like, oh yeah, Glenn Greenwald, when you mentioned him, I was like, yeah. Because you have him, and I was going to say, like, Van Jones, I'd kind of thrown that too. Not necessarily that I thought he was, like, a great journalist, but, like, he was at least, like, a more trusted media voice, but now he's just kind of wishy-washy.
He definitely started off as that, like, but what does this mean for... Because he was very good at how does what's going on right now contradict fifth grade civics America?
Yes.
And that was, you know, the initial progressive voice I think we were introduced to as someone who would be like, doesn't this seem a little out of character for America? Like, that's the voice that was started. And then you either went the Warren or Bernie train, depending on who you were. But that's neither here or there. But then with Glenn, that was someone who was, a critic of U.S. imperialism out the gate. And I just, what the fuck happened?
I wish I knew. Like, it's a lot of people like him. It's just weird where, like, I think there was just this hope that they had that, like, I guess Trump would just destroy everything. So they just supported him in his efforts to dismantle existence itself, I guess. I don't know. It's because it's so bizarre, but I think, like, we kind of talked a little bit about this in some other episodes about, like, you know, kind of like, you know, going native or, like, being captured by wherever you are. I mean, I don't know what it is that just something has, like, changed these people, but it's, like, kind of like that risk of, I think, journalism in general, where, like, you know, it's ultimately journalists are people and people are imperfect, and, you know, they can change and have flaws in general that may or may not impede their job. I was kind of thinking, this is an aside, but it was related to when you were talking about the I laughed a bit when you were talking about, like, the mythology of journalism and how we kind of, like, they sort of put themselves on a mountain, because now you graduated, I think, the year after me, but at my graduation ceremony, the person who gave the speech, like, the student who gave the speech, was a journalist major. Mm-hmm. I vividly remember her saying that she was willing to die for, like, the quest for the truth. And it's like just literally like everything you just said about how like they there's just this mythology for it embodied in this one person at this one moment.
Yeah, only like cavalry chargemen believe that shit about themselves. You know what I mean?
And I think, you know, it's like, I don't think, like, I don't think journalism is, like, totally dead and done yet. And, like, I think investigative journalism will always have value. I think, honestly, the real issue I think it has is just its competition with idiots with a podcast, talking heads on the media who don't really do the work and whatnot. Because I think that that's, like, when that's where, like, the money is, right? Because that's the stuff that gets more views, gets more consumption, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's less demand, there's less resources then to actually put towards like the real quality journalism. That's my concern. And I guess it remains to be seen whether or not how much that takes hold.
I for one am not competing with investigative journalism. Ken Klippenstein, please come on. We love you here.
I say idiots of a podcast, I prefer not to.
But the pod save guys, you know what I mean? Like, there's a certain class of, because now it's like you don't need cable media to do it. You just need to be the guy with a platform. And the pod save guys kind of exist conveniently to like obscure and deflect. Like,
When even like your podcasts that aren't even necessarily political, like, you know, even like your Joe Rogans now are like ostensibly political.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like they kind of just I don't know what to do about it other than like it's not the overarching or sorry, I don't know how to say it other than it's not like the overarching narrative that would be created by consuming several hours of cable news. And it's more of individual contractors just like spouting more of it into the ether.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you remember like earlier this year, because I think maybe just understanding like everything that's happened in 2021 in terms of like the coverage around the Biden administration may be useful to unpack. But do you remember when the PodSave guys were really big on criticizing progressives or left-wing critics of the Biden administration of saying, oh, they're accusing him of Green Lantern syndrome, or they believe in Green Lantern syndrome, or if only he willed it enough, that would be. And it's just one of those things that, like, when you really examine it, it's like, why are you saying that's stupid? Like, there is a clear question of willpower. It is a literal analysis of political will. And you're trying to come out as the smart guy by saying, actually, political will isn't what informs politics. Then what does?
Yeah, and I think that like they're trying to do is they're trying to mischaracterize like the criticism that there's that lack of political will for saying that like, oh well, you guys are just saying that like if he said like it's done, which isn't exactly how it is, but it does feel like at times that and maybe it's just that like Biden is just a really bad communicator at it, but like. And just maybe he does really care and really want these things, but just isn't adequate at expressing it to anyone, which is a problem in and of itself. But, you know, like it's but I think that like, there's a very big difference between like someone who's, you know, you feel at least is fighting for you and someone who you don't think is. And they're really kind of undermining that more realistic critique by kind of, you know, strawmanning it into something else.
That's just me contemplating how you wipe Positive America out the ether. I'm sorry. Like, that's kind of what they do, is they just like mischaracterize other people. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah, I mean, you're not gonna like pretend that we're 100% innocent of that either. I'm sure we've done that once or twice, but like, I don't think that we're, I don't know. I mean, it's just like, it's one of those annoying things that, you know, guys like that just sort of have this, they like, it's sort of the difference between when you have like a commitment to like your ideal of like a group or a party or an organization versus having like an ideology of yourself and sort of seeing how that maps out onto the organizations and people in the political mm-hmm. environment. And I think, you know, what like, you know, Pod Saves America and like a lot of those other things are sort of guilty of is sort of like that, you know, they kind of adapt. And I think, you know, it kind of relates back to our critique of like the media in general, that like it sort of is shaped by like, how do we configure our, like, you know, maybe to some extent our own ideologies to fit with the people that we have some admiration for. And I we didn't talk about this earlier, but we probably should a little bit, is did you see like the it was like a month or two ago with the controversy with Katie Couric
over RBG? Oh my yes. gosh, we can get into that. Yeah,
because it's like, I mean, I think it's maybe like the best example of just like the media literally co-opting itself to cover for, in this case, a Democratic figure, but, you know, someone who is in political power, where RBG had said something that was kind of, like, when asked about the Colin Kaepernick thing, I can't remember what exactly she said, but she basically wasn't in favor of it. She didn't necessarily like the kneeling before the flag, so Couric either, I can't remember if she just didn't include that at all, or if she changed her answer. I think she just didn't include it.
Well, so this is where it gets fun, because two things. One, what you were saying about we're just trying to make justifications for why the people we've tied ourselves to aren't getting something done. That's basically the mechanism for QAnon. So QAnon really started out of like the Obama guys were like, no, trust me, Obama is fighting the deep state. Like, I feel like there's a straight line. But coming to that point too of like RBG, I recall another interview she did where the same thing happened, where she was speaking in regards to the kneeling for the flag. And I don't think this was Colin Kaepernick by name, but she explicitly said she thought what they were doing was stupid, because yeah. And it was the statement she made.
Which is funny too, because like I do remember that interview as well. And it further raised questions like, well, why did you even cover up for her in the
here's first why they had to cover it up, because what she said was that how dare you show disrespect to a flag that has given you and your people rights. Yes. Which is the peak RBG thing to say. she's horrible, and like she's always said things like she holds that fifth grade civics view of America the strongest, I feel, where this is, you know, a country that has done imperial acts and has, you know, subjugated people. And when those people, even though they may have advanced within its ranks to some degree, still face injustice and decide to say something, she will come out and say, how dare you? And the funny thing is that, you know, MSNBC, because is that the network Katie Couric works at? She works with MSNBC, right?
Was it there? Was that when she was working at Yahoo?
I feel like, yeah, the thing is I feel like Yahoo has definitely, you know, every network has now done the thing where it's like, whether or not they're pro BLM, they definitely have a Black Voices section, which is just like stories featuring Black people for white consumers to look at.
Yeah.
If we're really being honest about what that sphere is. But I feel like, you know, Katie Couric, in what she said of why she did it, it's like, she hears that and she's like, I cannot let that get out there.
Yeah.
And intentionally doctor the clip for whatever, you know. And you know why. You know why she did it. Because if RBG says that, the entire notorious RBG image is called into question. And by mm-hmm. token, the entire vision of the Democratic Party as the protector of fifth grade civics America is called into question. You can't let that happen.
Yeah, I mean, the protector of the fifth grade civics is really like, I think it's like the best like parallel, right? It's this idealized version of America. And, you know, to some extent, protecting that means doing the right thing and sort of trying to live up to those ideals. But other times it just means like shoving certain things under the rug, and this, like this. And I think this was, and I mean, I think it, you know, it's just sort of the problem in general, right? Of like, you know, these political figures are, they're also people, they're flawed, and that's fine. Like, even if you disagree with them, it's fine. But like, when you try to portray them in this, you know, holy light, you know, like they're these sacred cults, like worthy of cult like worship, people, that's a problem. And it's funny because we you know, we criticize, like, you know, we like the, you know, like liberals in general, you know, criticize conservatives for like their feverish admiration of Trump. Yet you see a lot of the same people that do that have this very comparable devotion to people like RBG, Hillary Clinton, etc., Obama, etc. Yeah.
But it's to the point where it's like, now you have to start standing like Joe Manchin. How?
Yeah.
I can't justify getting that Kristen Sinema Funko Pop. I gotta be honest with you.
Oh my god. Is that actually a thing? I have to know.
All I know is that there's definitely an RBG one, and there's definitely a Bernie one, a Trump one, and a Hillary one.
Yeah. Those at least made sense. Though, I mean, it is weird where they are. It feels like there's like been some weird media push. I don't know the exact outlets have been doing it, but I've been trying to push the same thing for like a Kristen Sinema. It's like, oh, she's this triathlete bisexual woman, like, ooh, like just like the holy trinity of things to aspire. Like, I don't know, it's just bizarre.
Yeah, it's like a weird, like, I feel like they just saw like fandom for like pop culture, and they're like, no, we can just create politics based on fandom. We can try and
make, I mean, she dresses like a pop culture character,
but it's, I mean, just, like,
I don't think she's necessarily like casting herself in the positive light she thinks she is. I mean, she looks closer to like, I can't remember the one girl, the crazy lady from the Hunger Games who actually, you know, takes him off for tribute. That's who she looked closely resembles. And it seems like an appropriate comparison in general, but.
Well, again, like Hillary Clinton and RBG were like the model of this. And like with Hillary Clinton, it's like she's a trailblazer, you know, as a woman in politics. Her specific politics, when you ask a couple of Hillary stans like what it is, you'll either get the kind of person who like will kind of stutter their way through it, or you get
someone who's, they just self-project.
They self-project, or even better, they don't want to talk about DOMA at all. You know what I mean? And then with RBG, it's even weirder because it's like, as a man, I shouldn't be commenting on feminism. And I'm going to preface everything I say with that. But radical movements can be co-opted and commodified. We know this. And pop feminism did that with, you know, its most visibly representative women in power. So with RBG, you have a long-serving female justice in the Supreme Court. You can say that she writes scathing dissents, and you think that's cool. What does scathing dissent mean other than she fucking lost the case each time?
Yeah.
What does...
Well, it's weird, too, because I mean, I was thinking, like, even on like the conservative side of it, like people like talk about like, oh, Scalia wrote some like really good dissents. It's like, who cares?
Who cares?
Like, that's not legal precedent. That's not legally binding.
Like, so it's you have an essayist basically who wears a fucking scarf. You project your admiration for 80s hip hop onto this judge who, when pushed on Colin Kaepernick, says she like basically did like, she did racism. I don't know how else to say it. That's one of the most racist things I've heard out of a Democrat's mouth since Jim Crow. I'm going to be perfectly honest. And
it's really sort of the problem with like people from a certain generation too, right? Like, because it's like, that's probably not
a generation, but a certain class. Because like, once you make it to being like a high-powered lawyer and a high-powered, like, I mean, you make it to the Supreme Court, you can afford to say shit like that because America has worked for you.
Yeah, well, and I mean, when on the Supreme Court, I mean, you have no real consequences unless you do something really wrong and illegal, which no one's done in a while. But yeah, and it's kind of funny because I was thinking like,
well, you could do wrong a very, and like, things and still get on the court. I mean, look at
yeah, because like it is a very like classist generational thing for her to think, and it makes sense. And it kind of, I mean, I was mentioning before we went on the podcast that, you know, I went and saw James Clyburn speak earlier this week, and I remember one of the questions was about social media and kind of its role in like radicalizing people and stuff like that, and his answer was about cable news. And like how, like, oh, you know, when I was, you know, growing up, there was only like the, with a few key stations, right? You know, there's the ABC, MSNBC, you know, like there wasn't, or CBC, I can't remember which ones, but you know, there wasn't like Fox News, there wasn't CNN, etc. And it's like, okay, that's great. But you completely ignored the whole social media because that was what you were asked about. And it's probably because the only reason you have any engagement with it is because someone in your staff finally said, like, you really should have a Twitter account. And you're like, fine, you manage it for me. And it's just like, it's kind of that like generational tone deafness to certain things. It's like, I mean, I don't totally disagree with what he was necessarily saying about those things, but you're ignoring the broader implications of things because you're just tone deaf because you are just not cultured with it, because it's not something that was part of your rearing. Same way with, you know, RBG and Colin Kaepernick and, you know, black people stepping on flags. Or not that he was even doing anything that extreme. It was just, you know, kneeling during the anthem, but still, like, it's just kind of that weird dichotomy of just like, they are not, we have this sort of generational gap in awareness of things that is reflected. And it's a particular problem with the courts because of lifetime appointments. But,
and I think that's one of the most telling things of the media today is hiding the gerontocracy.
Yeah. And like kind of gaslighting in a way. Right.
Right.
We, you know, there's a little, you'll occasionally get a little bit of it where, like, because presidents are more public figures, when Joe Biden gets a little tongue tied, for reasons that probably aren't even entirely due to age, but sometimes, you know, I'm not saying he's losing his mind, but there's sometimes where I'm like, what on earth is he saying? But, you know, like some of that stuff, when it's so public that you can't like just pretend it didn't happen, then we'll engage with it. But other than that, we have to kind of like just cast, you know, put the curtain down,
well, pretend nothing's happening. And this happening. Is especially after, you know, a lot of over-reporting over, not to bring Bernie up again, but like, you know, oh, Bernie, is Bernie Sanders too old? That was like a favorite talking point. And then
which was weird, just paired with, as I said, you know, you had the stuff with Joe Biden where like,
he was bleeding out his eye. He was bleeding out his eye on a stage and they won't even bring it up. We are being gaslit in the greenhouse. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah.
But again, it's like any question of Biden's age, because it's like you see them do it and it's like, well, what if I ask the same question by your, you know, you do the by your logic thing. They can just come out with like a new generation of ageists is attacking Biden's age. You can't. But I mean, that's kind of what it is.
Well, even to be fair, even Sanders had to defend Joe Biden as being attacked for ageism. But that's, I mean. I guess Bernie, when you are a certain age, you kind of have to like say
they trot Bernie out in front of the media and just like have him do the PR job. Dude, let him retire. Y'all hit him with the CIA heart attack gun. Y'all won't let him win the primary. Fine, just let him retire, guys. I'm just gonna say it. Sanders 2024, absolutely not. Look at what this country does to him every time he runs. Just let him retire. He's done more than enough.
I think the sad thing is just right. Like, well, who else would you want? I don't think you have a good answer for that either.
I mean, I feel like it's a good point maybe to get to this question is like, how do you feel about national politics? Because I'm kind of at the point where it's like, I don't see a problem in tuning out of national elections. I don't see a problem in only participating in like your local and state elections, focusing on those, and just if you feel like national politics is going nowhere, it's okay to pack up your ball and go, because I really don't see it going anywhere right now.
Kind of. I mean, part of me, and like, it's sort of that pain prevention mentality of like, going nowhere is better than like going backwards. And like obviously, yeah, like if Trump does like want to run in 2024, or any of his, you know, like Nikki Haley, all these, Tom Cotton, like any of these people, I do not want, like, I don't ever want to like see them on TV again, let alone as like the president. Mm-hmm. You know, so like, I'm not totally I think like just mentally, I don't think I'd ever be able to tune out, you know, maybe that's a, speaks to me and my mental health, but yeah, I kind of agree with you. I don't necessarily feel tremendous optimism. It feels like a lot of, it feels like things are increasingly performative. I think, you know, like the UN had that climate summit, and like, God, it just felt hollow. Like, it didn't feel like a complete joke. Like, as I mean, I can't remember if Trump even went to any of those, but like, those felt like jokes. Where it's like, oh, you know, I guess, you know,
we've just been repeating the Kyoto Protocol at each one, if we're being perfectly honest.
Yeah, and it's, but like, this just felt, it just was like, oh, let's flip a coin for climate change. It's like, yeah, like, and then there was jokes about how like some of them like were really late behind it. Like, of course, they're only willing to throw out money when they've seen other people are willing to throw out money, and it's like the perfect metaphor for
right
the climate response.
I mean, Joe was asleep for half of it, if I recall. Like,
hey, you know, jet lag.
I mean, listen, if they, I would be perfectly okay if they just decided, fuck it, we're just gonna run Joe out there raw. Let's at least get our entertainment value for this. And I would just love to see him off his rocker, just talking to journalists unprovoked.
It is weird. He does feel like, God, I hate to like embrace that like Biden in his basement rhetoric, and you know, like that narrative that we really latched onto during the campaign. But like, he doesn't feel as like visible as he like maybe should. And like, I get that there's, you know, there's weird idiosyncrasies that he has. He's kind of always been that way. It's not like totally an age thing, but like, yeah, just run him out raw every once in a while and kind of get, you know, right, get a laugh. He's out
unmedicated,
of it.
You know what I mean?
Like the, you know, the, when the journalist asked him a question about, was it the Israel-Pakistan one where he was like in the car and just drove off, like just floored it. Like, that was funny. Like, I mean, yeah, like it was his flippancy towards the issue. Good. No, but
because like,
sometimes you just have to get a laugh out of these things, right? If you can't get a policy outcome you like, at least get,
because like the policy, like the talk he gave like after pulling out of Afghanistan, that was fun. That was fun. Where he's just like, listen here, Jack, there was no other way we could have done it. Come on, man. That was,
well,
great.
I mean, well, to some extent too. I mean, like, that's what you probably already like kind of agreed with. But it's like, yeah, you know, it's like, let us just enjoy the entertainment on some level, right?
Dude, and I want to see more of his Irish trickery, like him farting in front of Camilla. That's payback to the fucking crown. Hey, let's just get Biden out there and like, okay, nothing fucking changes, but we get a free and independent Ireland. 26 plus 6 equals 1, folks. Let's, come on. Let's just get that for all that we're going to ring out of the world.
I'm just wondering, like, if that happened because of Biden, would that be portrayed as like an international disaster by the media, or would they like?
No, they would portray as an international disaster. For me, it is a liberation of a colonized and oppressed people. I have to stand that.
And you thought Biden was just a, you know, continuation of the same empire. Shame on you.
Damn it. Oh my gosh. I don't know. I think with respect to maybe how to move forward with some of this stuff, like, I think it's okay to not pay attention to some of this stuff. A lot of it is spectacle. A lot of it is, you know, the same culture war arguments you've heard 20 times by now. And they just get reflavored. They get reseasoned. It's like reheating leftovers, then putting them back in the fridge, then reheating them for infinity. That's what this discourse is. That's what this media cycle is. I think what people maybe should do more of, aside from consuming their politics, consuming their news, is like, if you put yourself into a local project of importance, that's more meaningful political participation, because there's no activism in any of this. There's no activism in consuming cable news. There's no activism in producing or even listening to this podcast or any other. It's only through action and praxis that you'll get anything done. Now, of course, staying, you know, informed, getting your news, doing your reading, that's all critical, that's important, and I need to do more of it. But this kind of spectacle, you're not going to stop it by getting mad about it. Just stop paying attention. There's nothing else you can really do.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to close this, to be honest. I think, you know, as you said, you know, it's, you're not under any obligation to engage with this content to be like an informed citizen. I mean, obviously, you know, I think it's important that you're, you know, on some level aware of what's going on, but I think, you know, there are alternatives to 24-hour news. There are alternatives to podcasts that sort of have an, you know, sort of implicit agenda to it. And I think, like, it's one thing when, like, I mean, I think we are pretty open about this. This is largely commentary, right? We're not necessarily giving you the news, right? I mean,
we are not a primary source. We are a tertiary source at best.
Right. And I mean, I think, you know, if we, it's very old school news format anyways, where things are multiple weeks late. like back in the day of, you know, having to mail letters and whatnot. But, you know, it's like you said, that's, you know, stay engaged, but don't feel that you need to, you know, wholly subscribe to the way it's being digested and put out before you. Obviously, a lot of this is sort of the same genre, same rough thing, just given a slightly new flavor, adding a little spice to it. Culture war issues ad infinitum. Kind of glad we didn't talk as heavily about those today as we have in the past. Kind of surprised we managed.
Because, like, I don't know if you feel this way, but I'm tired of repeating myself.
Yeah, that's fair.
And it's like, and I've said it well enough on a past episode, I don't need to make that my pet issue. This is not bad faith.
Yeah.
God, where's Virgil? That's another thing for podcast TMZ. I'm not going to get into that. But, you know, I would just say that, you know, we all are prone to engaging in entertainment that triggers all those pleasure centers. You get a serotonin boost by looking at drama. It's okay. It's engineered to do that. But what I would say is, like, if something doesn't have a sensible or concrete action item for you, it's not activism. It's not praxis. It's just content. And that's fine. We live in a content economy on the internet. Everyone has to make takes, make videos, make podcasts, and they're fun to engage in. But just understanding the net level of actual action they produce, which is very minimum, just understanding that will give you a little more relief. So, I mean, that's all I got. Any closing thoughts from you, Josh?
I think we've kind of gone through everything.
Yeah, it was a bit messy. I'm sorry about that, listeners, but, you know, there was a lot on our minds, and I think it's, you know, worth doing a little fall and winter cleaning, not just with your home, but mentally, physically, spiritually, yeah, whatever, sure. Whatever you need to do. So yeah, Josh, where can people follow you if they want to hear more from you?
I am on Twitter at At Joshua costs, or at Joshua.cost 17. And actually, no, there's no dot. It's Joshua costs 17. My bad. And that's all I've got for right now as far as major socials to follow.
All right. This show is Greenhouse Gaslighting. You can follow us on Twitter at @PodGreenhouse, or you can follow me, Adi, on Twitter at Fibonacci Sniper. I will have all our social media links posted in the description. Till next time, thanks for tuning in, dear listeners. See you soon at the Greenhouse. Take care.
And by the way, you know, I sit on the stand and it get hot. I got a lot of, I got hairy legs that turn, that turn blonde in the sun. And the kids used to come up and reach in the pool and rub my leg down. So it was training them to watch the hair come back up again. They'd look at it. So I learned about roaches. I learned about kids jumping on my lap. And I've loved kids jumping on my lap. And I tell you what. The men, they're now all men, the guys I work with down here, and they're all guys at the time. They're all good men. Most of them made an awful lot of themselves. And Earl Larkin had a rough time. And some of you knew Earl.
I came back.